Thank you very much, Dick Wainwright, and aloha ka kahi aka one and all. Welcome to this edition of Talk Story, and delighted that Governor Linda Lingle is in studio with us today. Governor, good morning to you.
Good morning, Rick. Great to be here.
Boy, you've had a busy couple of days. Saw you traveling out to Rabbit Island, I believe it was, and a whole lot of things going on. We're going to get caught up with everything, but how are you doing so far?
Everything's going great, Rick. We are concerned about the slight contraction you're seeing in the economy because of some of the mainland issues that we're facing. Obviously, the worldwide price of oil is an issue. The credit crunch is also an issue because of our main market being in California. People there have been hit hard by the decline in housing prices, the foreclosures going on. At the same time, it's been a great week for us from a broader economic perspective because nationally, our rankings, both by Forbes magazine, have jumped up very high. And what they do is each year they rate all 50 states and they said, what's the best place to do business in the country and what's the worst? And in 06, we were ranked 42nd. We knew we had a lot of work to do. Mm-hmm. Last year, we jumped to 37. This year, we jumped up 10 spots. We were 27th in the nation. And that is really great progress. Again, it doesn't, I know, address the individual hardship of a job loss, but it says that our fundamentals are getting in place. We're lowering the taxation structure, lowering fees, declining regulation that strangles mm-hmm. business opportunities. We're moving into the science and technology in the schools. Our workforce development is on track. So it says when the economy does turn internationally and nationally, our fundamentals are in place, and I'm very excited about that. So being ranked 27th in the country is very good compared to where we are. There was one other ranking that came out. This was in the Milken Institute, mm-hmm. and they rate states on what they call the Technology and Science Index. So how are you doing in creating the atmosphere and the jobs in the science and technology sector? And there in 04, we were 39th. This year, we're 28th in the nation. So again, making really good progress. And what they said this year about our jump in the science and technology field is that the state was especially targeting clean energy and life sciences, and that's exactly where we want to be positioned.
And so, that's been a great deal of our conversations here on the program as well.
Especially on the energy side,
certainly.
Definitely.
I'd like to remind folks, it wasn't that long ago that these Forbes reports were the fodder for a great deal of criticism for the state of Hawaii, to the point where there was some, you know, pretty pronounced statements about our viability as a state at large. And to see this big turnaround is really promising.
Well, you remember Forbes in 02, Rick, when I used to come on your show, they came out with that article called Trouble in Paradise. Mm-hmm. And at that time they said, why doing business in Honolulu has become nearly equivalent to suicide and Fidel Castro would feel right at home here.
I remember that.
And
yeah.
it really was an attitude to a large degree, but also some of the fundamental laws had to be changed. And as you know, this year we just implemented in January a very large reduction in the unemployment insurance tax that employers paid. And it's a 3-year program. It will save employers $151 million over that 3 years. And the great thing about this change, which we fought so hard for in the legislature, is that it affected every single business mm-hmm. because every business has to pay mm-hmm. the unemployment insurance tax.
Mm-hmm. And that due to such a burgeoning surplus, so to speak,
of
the funds.
That's exactly why we were able to lower the unemployment insurance rate is because we had built up this huge fund because for so long we had the lowest unemployment in the nation.
Right. And how are we doing unemployment rate-wise?
I don't know the rate for this month. It obviously has crept up some percentage points, some fraction of percentage points, starting with the Aloha, the ATA, Molokai mm-hmm. Ranch, and some of those layoffs. We also had a couple of hotels closed for renovation, such as the Royal Hawaiian. Mm-hmm. But when they open up, there'll be tremendous properties with great new amenities and a big investment in the construction sector. So again, Rick, I don't think there's any way you can adequately understand the feeling of a job loss. It's just one of those life situations that is one of the very worst. But we have worked very hard through our Department of Labor and the what we call the rapid response team. When we don't wait to be called in. When we see a business is laying off some people, we get out there with our team. We make certain that people know their rights, their benefits to unemployment, to medical insurance. But most importantly, to their future through job training and assistance in community college, whatever they need to do to get back into the job market and to upgrade their skills. I think one of the saddest things that occurred after the Aloha shutdown, I saw people interviewed on television who said, you know, I worked there 20 years and I knew how to use a computer, but only to make reservations. So here's a company really didn't upgrade the skills of the employees over time. And I think to the individual employee, each of us, it's our responsibility to keep our skills up to date, because the younger people are coming out. That's just like them using a computer is like us using a pencil. And
certainly,
and you're going to have to compete. So our labor department realizes this, that some of the workers who are facing job loss have been at the same job for quite a while, and that's what we bring in the rapid response team, is the ability to learn new skills during a very difficult time of their life.
And just as a sidebar on that, I noted that with, unfortunately, the job losses at Maui Land and Pine, that within and this is just the news cycle, let alone what actually the timeline was. We had the announcement on one day. The next day, the team was already on its way. So when you talk about rapid response, it truly is. There is no languishing before there is some activity.
Well, I give Maui Land and Pine credit, Rick. They came in. They requested a meeting with me a day or two before the announcement. I had my labor director with me at that meeting so that he could follow up to understand not just the number of people who were facing job loss, but what were the characteristics of the people? Where were they in their own skill sets? What did we need to do so that when that announcement was made, they were able to come in with knowledge about the people they were dealing with? Because each person is an individual. We don't treat it as just one big mass and give them generalized information, but actually try to address the issues that they're facing. Give them the kind of information that will help them get back into the job market as quickly as possible.
We're going to continue, and I'm sure that the economy will be part of our conversation as the hour goes on, but other pertinent topics, including top headlines in today's news stories regarding the HSTA and also teachers and the state negotiator. We're going to talk with the governor about this and many other topics on the agenda for this morning. Glad that you're with us here. With Governor Linda Lingle, this edition of Talk Story will continue in just a moment. 20 past the hour, and we're together here on our network of stations all throughout the 50th state. This edition of Talk Story reaching all throughout Hawaii with Governor Linda Lingle. Governor, of course, it's top of the full today and dominated television news last night. The situation regarding the negotiations with HSTA, contracts, etc. Where are we right now?
Well, we're at a difficult point right now, Rick, because we are about to enter negotiations with the teachers union for the following two-year contract, and it makes it impossible to negotiate with people who you can't trust. And that's what's happened. There's been a complete breakdown in trust between the HSTA union leadership and our state negotiator. And it's been brought about because ever since we negotiated the contract over a year ago, Rick, it was clear everybody understood what this meant, that we were going to offer raises at a certain level, very generous raises to the teachers. And in return, we were going to require random drug testing. Now, the teachers voted on it, over 60% ratified it, so they understood it, and they said, okay, we understand the terms, and we agree, and they voted. And they were supposed to be working this year, the HSTA leadership and the Department of Education, to come up with the process that they would use. Now, it's important to note that this is not something brand new. Obviously, the police officers have random drug testing. The firefighters have random drug testing. Even the people who drive forklifts in the UPW, they have a commercial driver's license, they have random drug testing. It's already in place all across the government. So it wasn't something you had to invent from scratch. And you remember when a few months went by, they started to argue that it was too expensive to do random drug testing. And when we pointed out to them that random doesn't mean you need to test thousands and thousands of people, it means that everybody knows it could be them who gets tested. Mm-hmm. So I suggested to them that they test 1% of the teachers. And what that means is there are 12,000 teachers, you would test 120 teachers per year. That's 10 teachers per month, Rick. That's not very many. Right. It's about $35 per drug test. So their argument about the huge expense was because in their approach, they wanted to set up a bureaucracy, an office of drug testing in the DOE, hire 9 new people and highly paid supervisors. It was really ridiculous. Mm. And so when that argument fell, when we pointed out that random just means just a few, but nobody knows who might get tested, and it's that uncertainty that would hopefully lead people not to bring drugs or to come to campus drunk or on drugs. Well, when that argument fell, then they raised a constitutional argument. Now, they had a year to request an attorney general's opinion, but they didn't until the 11th hour. They've now been given that opinion, which says that they voluntarily gave up their right to privacy, which they were arguing under the Constitution, mm-hmm. because they got the vote on the agreement. So that argument then fell. Then they filed what really was the silliest of all. They said, well, what they really meant when they agreed to this is that this would only cover teachers who had a commercial driver's license.
Oh, my.
Well, two things, Rick. There are no teachers in Hawaii in the public schools with a commercial driver's license, mm-hmm. unless they have it because they have a different job outside, in other words, of the teaching profession on their own time. But also, it's already a federal requirement that everyone with a commercial driver's license be drug tested randomly. So why would we have bargained for something that exists already under the law and there are no teachers who have that CDL? So it was one after the other. But I think what finally brought the state negotiator, Marie Laderta, and the Deputy Attorney General, Jim Halverson, out yesterday to talk with the media about this issue is they felt the teachers themselves weren't getting an accurate accounting from their union leaders. And they were very concerned about this because it's obviously making the teachers look terrible.
Exactly.
Because they didn't live up to their agreement. They came up with flimsy excuses. And now this last one was so ridiculous, but they actually produced a newsletter, Rick, that compared the removal of their constitutional right to a drug test. They compared it to the internment of Japanese Americans during the war, the Second World War. And I can tell you, our state negotiator and the deputy attorney general were just completely upset about this because it's just so far from the truth, Rick, and it's painting such a false picture. We think the general community sees through all of this, but we wanted the teachers to know what their leaders are actually doing. And this last filing about having it only apply to people with a commercial driver's license really was just too much, sort of the last straw. So I would tell you that it will make negotiations very, very difficult going forward because the basis of collective bargaining is there has to be trust on both sides. And we work with many unions. Some are easier than others, but you have to have some level of trust. And in this case, the HSTA leadership, the trust has broken down completely.
See, this is, and we'll go to our callers in just a moment, but this is the confusing or at least the murky part of the story. Leadership in the union is supposed to represent the wishes and the intent of their membership. The agreement has been struck. It's well documented, very legal, as you know, very transparent in the proceedings. How can they justify at any turn to turn on a heel, to renege on a contract or an agreement that was already established? How in conscience can they do that, not only ethically, but also legally? Aren't there legal ramifications for not adhering to what has already been codified?
Well, it looks as if we're going to head down that road to answer those questions, Rick. But I will say when the contract was negotiated, the head of the HSTA was Joan Husted. She's a person we had worked with for years. We had a high level of trust. I believe she entered into this contract honestly and forthrightly. But in between signing the contract and having it voted on by the membership and a few months later, there was a change of leadership, mm-hmm. and Mike McCartney came in as the leader of HSTA, and that's what has created this mistrust now. With Joan Husted, again, I'd negotiated with her since I became governor, and we had no issues of trust with her, but we've had a lot of issues since McCartney came in.
Let's go to Gary, who is in Pearl City today. Just a few moments to spend together, Gary, but thanks for the call. You're on with the governor.
Okay, good morning, Rick. Good morning, Governor Lingle. Just a couple of questions that I have, because I've been listening for about the last hour since Rick was discussing everything. You talk about negotiating trust and good faith and everything, but how can you say that when the contract was never really negotiated? About half of the meetings your chief negotiator walked out of, and then they come right before convention, and they said, here is a non-negotiable item. If you do not take this, you do not have a contract.
Well, Gary, a couple of things. Our negotiator participates as a member of the negotiating team, and they are there for the meetings. I was personally on the phone with members of the Board of Education at the very end of this negotiation for this contract that we're talking about. And once the agreement was struck with the negotiating teams on both sides, Gary, again, it goes out to the membership. So the members have an opportunity at that stage to say, you know, we don't like what's been negotiated here. But it was over 60% did like what was negotiated. And it's because the public was very generous with the teachers in granting them raises and other benefits. And this one provision, which gave them 1 year to get it implemented. Again, when you bargain in good faith, you say, I'm really going to try to do this. But the pattern that's been developed here, which is first it was an issue of cost, and then that issue was struck down by the facts. And then the second issue was it's unconstitutional, but that has been struck down by the facts. And now to come up with this, really, it's a silly argument that only people with a commercial driver's license should be covered by this. It would nullify everything that was agreed to. So from our perspective, the leadership of HSTA simply not bargaining in good faith. They did not bargain in good faith.
Gary, unfortunately, we got to run. I appreciate your question very much, and thank you for your patience. We'll pick up the conversation coming up after our bottom of the hour break. When we return, we'll hear from the island of Maui, where Joe is on board. And other topicality, of course, with Governor Linda Lingle. Clean Energy Initiative is amongst that, plus news on the Waianae Coast. And we'll have more of your calls as well. You're dialed into this edition of Talk Story. 36 past the hour. Thanks for being with us. Our conversation with Governor Linda Lingle continues. And we are focusing just for this few minutes in regard to the negotiations with HSTA regarding contracts, etc. And the governor, of course, with explanations and insight. We're going to go to the Valley Isle and find out from Joe what's on his mind today. And Joe, thanks for the call. You're on with Governor Linda Lingle. Good morning.
Okay, good morning to you guys.
Morning.
Hi, Joe.
Could it be that they're playing the stalling game so that they can get the drugs out of their system? This makes it sound like all the teachers are druggies and they can stall long enough, get them off drugs before just enough to pass the test. That's what it smells like anyway.
Joe, thank you very much for the call.
Well, Rick, that's a sad part of this because it does reflect poorly on the teachers. Whatever the reasons are, it reflects poorly on them, and the decisions aren't being made by them but by these their supposed leaders, the people who are supposed to represent them, but they're not representing them because over 60% of the teachers voted for this contract, which included this provision for reasonable random drug testing. And again, I think 1 year was a reasonable amount of time to get it implemented. It doesn't involve thousands of people. Again, I just approached it and said, look, 1%, test 1% a year in a random fashion, and it wouldn't have cost much.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have taken them away from their main responsibility, which is the education of our children. And that's the other sad thing about this whole episode over the past year, is that it deflects attention from the purpose of education, which is preparing our children to be able to compete in a global economy in any field that they choose. If they choose to stay at home, they can compete. If they want to go away, they can compete. And that's where our attention is, and that's why we're so focused on STEM skills, that science, technology, engineering, and math, and why we've brought robotics into the schools. We're excited about all these things. This year, there's going to be a great rollout, Rick, of what we are calling the creative academies in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
And this is for the young people. We're trying to tie in the creative side with the technology side, because a lot of our kids, they're interested in art, in music, and that's terrific. And too much of that has been taken out of the schools. And through these creative academies, we're going to bring it back into the schools, tie it into the technology side of education. So this drug testing is really a distraction and an unnecessary distraction because it's not burdensome, but it clearly is stating to the parents and to the community, we take this issue of drugs or drinking on campus by people who are supposed to be in leadership. We take it seriously enough to include this in a contract and to implement a random drug testing program. So hopefully smarter minds will prevail. The teachers will pressure their union officials to truly represent them, and we can get on with this.
Yeah, it really is. It's disheartening. And I was commenting earlier in the morning, that's the tough part about this story. And I'm hopeful that the general public will not cast aspersion on the individual teacher, but understand that this, and that's part of the issue here, and we'll wrap up with this, is that it's unfathomable why the leadership would take a position like this. It doesn't seem that there's any possible gain other than to try and exert authority as a union leader. That's the only conclusion many of us come to.
Well, we've tried the same thing you do, Rick, and that's to make a distinction between the teachers in the classroom and this union leadership, because they are not the same thing, and they're supposed to be, because you're supposed to represent your membership. But the membership voted to implement this program, and the union leadership simply dragging its feet, and again, we feel just bargaining in bad faith. So we'll let the state's chief negotiator continue to work through the Labor Relations Board and hopefully get this resolved. We'll focus in the meantime on our STEM skills, our creative academies, and creating atmospheres where both teachers and students can do well and excel in school.
I want to change gears if you don't mind. It is a story that did not receive a great deal of attention in our local press, but it's a story that really has tremendous implications. If you could talk a little bit about the work of Lillian Kohler and her department and some of the accomplishments in regard to foster children, et cetera, because I think it's something that we all should know about.
Well, thanks, Rick. You know, we are excited to have someone like Lillian Kohler heading the Department of Human Services. And a few years ago when we got there, there was a major issue in the community regarding the number of children who were in the foster care program. And this was a special concern of the Native Hawaiian community because Native Hawaiian children were being removed from their homes at much higher rates than other ethnic groups. And they were being placed with families who were not necessarily knowledgeable about their culture and their background. And so Lillian worked with the community to get Native Hawaiian churches and organizations involved to make certain that when we did have to remove a child for their own safety, we had an appropriate placement for them. But we really wanted to get a handle on how come so many children in our state were being taken out of their homes for foster care. In 2003, when Lillian started in her position, on any given day, there were 3,000 children in foster care. Currently, there are 1,700 children in foster care, so more than a 40% decrease over the past 5 years. Now, that by itself, you know, is a good thing. We're going in the right direction. But what's more important than that, Rick, is they have a statistic nationally that the federal government tracks in all states, and it's called a re-abuse rate. What that means is if a child was abused in a home, whether mentally, physically abused, they're taken out of the home, what is the percentage of children who are re-abused because they were put back in that family and something else happened? Nationally, the average is 6.1% is the re-abuse rate. In Lillian's department, when we got here, our rate was 6%. So it's just about what the national average is today. Since she's been in that position, it's gone from 6% in 2003 to 2.2% in 2007. It's one of the lowest reabuse rates in the nation. So by taking fewer children out, it's not endangering the children. In fact, they are doing better. And it's because a lot of the federal TANF spending that Lillian does is getting additional services into these families. So whether they needed extra child care, whether they needed parenting skills, whatever it was that they needed to create a healthier environment for the children was being done through these federal funds. Also, the social workers at DHS, who are really good people, Rick, and they're in a very difficult situation. There's nothing more emotional than breaking up a family. And I really feel for the workers in our department. But what Lillian created is, instead of a one-size-fits-all evaluation and removal of children from their biological parents, by the way, when we got here, it was four times the national average that children would four times the national average that children would be removed from their families. But what she did was she created this web-based system that weighs risk factors in the homes, and it gives the social workers more flexibility to work with the family, to work with other agencies, to try to keep the child with the family while providing counseling, parenting, and other social services. So Lillian and her team deserve a lot of credit, Rick. This is measurable, sustainable progress that they are making. And again, based on a system as opposed to just an individual deciding just because I think...
Almost arbitrarily.
Yeah. And again, it was so high. The rate of removal was just so high, in our opinion, that we had to have a change. And she figured it out. And so thanks for highlighting it, because it really is. It's a 15-year low in our state for the number of children in foster care.
Great story.
Yeah.
Great story to tell. We'll be back with more. And we'll open up the telephone lines if you'd like to join us at 521-8383 here locally, and for our good friends on the Neighbor Islands, 1-888-565-8383. Hope that you'll join us as well. More news and information. Conversation with Governor Linda Lingle continues in just a moment. 50 past the hour on our network of stations all throughout the 50th state, reaching all islands and all communities. Thanks so much for choosing us for this edition of Talk Story with Governor Linda Lingle. My name is Rick Amato, your host, and Governor, I know that there's an intriguing proposal that is actually being tested as we speak. It is the proposal of a four-day work week.
Well, it's very interesting, Rick. We have implemented a four-day work week in one of the state departments. It's called the Department of Human Resources, and this department is responsible for keeping all the positions filled in the government, and they have other responsibilities, but the important thing about them is no one in that department is a union member, and that's what allowed us to start so quickly with that department. Also, they tend to service internally the government, the different departments, so they don't have much interaction with the general public except those who are looking for jobs in the government. Mm-hmm. And they can access that online in any case. So we felt it was a good department to start with, so we've implemented a pilot program. And it's going to run, it started on Monday of this week.
Right.
And it runs through October 31st. And during that time, we're going to be evaluating all aspects to see if we could apply it to other departments, what adjustments might be needed. We're already talking with two other of our state departments. I don't want to mention them right now, but they have already had discussions with the unions. And the interesting thing about this is that I think the unions are getting encouragement from their members to move to this system, to give it a try.
Right.
And we have an online evaluation form for the people in the Department of Human Resources to come on to let us know how they think it's working. But the bottom line of the proposal and the project was that we were looking to find ways to ease traffic congestion out on the roads, to reduce costs to the general public by closing down one day out of the week. So theoretically, Rick, if you're not there one out of 5 days, it's 20% of the time you're not there. And so air conditioning and the lights and the computers, so you should save 20% of your energy usage. And we need to do that because with the increase in the price of electricity, we are not going to have enough money to pay for electricity if we continue at these rates of usage. And, of course, even though we've been able to reduce our usage in some cases, with the price continuing to go up, it's causing havoc with the budgets in all of the departments. And I've told them that they're going to have to figure it out because there just isn't any more money. As you know, the Council on Revenues, again, made a downward projection on revenue. So we're going to have to get more creative. And a part of the creativity and innovation was to try this four-day work week. So it also gives our employees one more day a week with their family or to run errands or to do whatever they might like to do on their extra day off. It also extends the hours of the department. So instead of working 8-hour days, you work four 10-hour days. And what that would mean, if it's a department that services the public, you can actually come in later in the day when you may be off work and get even better service. So we have said as a bottom line, Rick, we would not move to this system if it degrades public service at all. We want to maintain a level of public service that we currently enjoy. Hopefully we can improve it, but we certainly don't want to implement a system that causes public service levels to go down.
Right.
So again, we think you can save on the usage of oil because of the gasoline people save. It can save on electricity. It can improve the quality of life of our workers as well. So and again, it can extend the hours so that the public has more time to come in and get services. So we think there are a lot of pluses, but we're approaching it in a cautious way and finding out some of the kinks early on in the first department. But at the same time, we're not waiting. We're already talking with two other departments of the government.
You know, it's interesting because the concept of the extended time at work isn't such a, you know, a lot of resistance, I would imagine, because of our transportation issues that we have on the island, that, you know, folks would reconcile that to say, well, you know, I might as well stay at the office and might as well continue to work and alleviate some of the congestion to get back and forth to where we need to go. And ostensibly, that could be contributing to helping some of our transportation issues.
Well, I think the people generally like it. They like the idea of it. I think there are individuals who are going to face some challenges with childcare issues, with elder care. They care for their parents and they need to get back at a certain time. Those were the two major issues, Rick. Some of them have another job, so that may be an issue as well. But they surveyed, there were only about 110 people in this particular department, so they surveyed everyone and determined who had special issues and they worked through with them. But I would say the majority of people really like this movement to a four-day work week.
Yeah, I'd like that too. Let's, as we head to the top of the hour, we have just a few more minutes remaining. The homeless situation has been discussed at length, not only with us on this program, but it seems for years. It appears that in recent time, we've seen actual construction and also the opening of various facilities where people can really see that there has been movement and accomplishment in trying to alleviate this difficult condition. What's the latest on the Waianae Coast?
Well, as you know, Rick, our approach has always been not just to house homeless people, because that you could do. You can build barracks and put people in out of the elements. That's not our goal. Our goal is to create kind of a situation where a family can get their life back together and create independence, where they can go out and live on their own. So we don't just build a place for a person to sleep, but a place for them to learn the skills they need. And the latest one we're going to open, it's on August the 20th. It's out on the Waianae Coast, and this one is a partnership with the Hawaii Coalition of Christian Churches. It's a combination emergency and transitional housing for up to 250 individuals, and we do tend to focus on families. So at this facility, Rick, not only will there be a few emergency beds, but transitional housing means people can stay there up to a couple of years. They develop a life plan. At the facility, there will be preschool, there's a daycare center, case management, life skills training, vocational services, all the things that a person needs to get it together, to be able to go out and to compete in the open rental market and to live a good life in Hawaii. So I'm excited about this one. Pastor Boo Suarez has headed up the Coalition of Christian Churches. He's worked very hard. We have some money they've raised. There's a lot of state money in the project, some Weinberg money in the project, but it's going to be a real asset to the community, Rick, in my opinion. So we'll be out there on the 20th of August to open that up. We have two more shelters that will open up in the fall. One is at Kalailoa, and this is a former barracks that has been renovated. That'll open in September for up to 150 people. And then an exciting project, the Villages of Maile, will open in October. Again, 250 people will be able to stay there, and that's the one that the developer Stanford Carr built at no price. profit. This was the one time developers competed to build something where no profit would be made. And we actually did. We went out for a request for interest. So we said, great. Anybody out there who wants to build this, step forward. And Stanford did. So we appreciate very much what he did. He's taken a personal interest in it. And I really think it's going to make a difference in people's lives.
And on that note, we thank you so very much, Governor, and we look forward to our next conversation. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rick. Aloha.
Aloha, folks. Thanks for joining us.